I'm Felina Jean, and this is Black Broads Abroad. I'm an international woman of leisure who said peace out to the United States in 2011, and I have not looked back except at this ass, honey. Since then, I've lived on 4 continents, but traveled to over 40 countries. Along my journey, I've come to know some very compelling Black women from all over the world who also said fuck you to their comfort zones. I created this podcast to inspire Black women in the diaspora to take risks and live their very best lives. This has been such an interesting week and an even more interesting Mercury retrograde period. Like, typical business delays, I'm like a month past due for some very important deadlines. And no matter how much I have articulated this point, the people that I've hired to help me just don't seem to get it. Then I had a crazy misunderstanding over something so mundane with one of my best friends. And I don't use that term lightly because I only fuck with very few people the long way. The shit really took me aback, and it was clearly some shit that had been festering in her spirit for a minute, because the minutiae that caused the misunderstanding could not have been the crux of her issue. Woo fucking sigh. The miscommunication really came to a halt in a completely separate incident dealing with my hair. And if there is anything to know about me, I do not play about my hair, ever. Generally speaking, I don't let Africans style my hair, no shade. I'm just finicky and have a very particular African-American standard when it comes to my coif. And that standard does not exist here in South Africa, or really anywhere outside of the United States, to be fair. But when it comes to this braiding shit, hands down, continental African women got that shit on lock. But anyway, I cut my hair off at the top of the year, and I'm rocking like a platinum ash blonde natural. I style it on my own because, you know, back to that standard. But I do go to the barber for a shape up and to get my hair dyed. This man, so-called licensed barber, took the bleach off my hair, and my shit was coming out in clumps. And the color was two-tone. And, you know, when I get mad, I morph into a 6'5", 300-pound nigga. And the barber and the manager of the salon were, like, so cavalier about my hair falling out in real time. I definitely had some choice words for everybody in the salon that was complicit in this abomination of a hairstyle. Thank God for my beauty school dropout skills and that I was able to salvage my tresses and make it work. Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This the shit that makes me miss home so much. Aside from obviously, like, you know, some of my family members. But I digress. In other hair controversy, did y'all hear about the latest Kim K controversy with, yet again, not citing Black women for her whole everything? This time during Paris Fashion Week, she sported some box braids, and Sierra Constantinople, who I've actually worked with, she slayed my wigs when I was in Paris and got my model's hair together for a photo shoot in my former life as a weave slinger. Anyway, Kim K cited a white hairstylist as the source of her look and made no mention whatsoever of Sierra. The fucking nerve. But still not surprising. Black women are never cited for our creations, even the creation of all humans. Y'all gonna start respecting your mammies. Anyway, stick around for the interview today where I interview attorney Wani Iris Manley. She's super dope. She's an internationally renowned keynote speaker and author of a few best-selling books, and she packed her shit and moved to Paris like almost 6 or 7 years ago and has not looked back. We had a very insightful conversation about stepping out of comfort zones and the way that African women and African American women relate. But first,
let me tell y'all motherfuckers what happened last week.
So, Black History Month culminated last week, and to celebrate, your president had a cadre of yes, some mass ass niggas for a round table to sing his praises at the White House. Like to hear it? Here it go.
I am sitting next to the greatest president since Abraham Lincoln. Yeah.
The greatest president.
Yeah. Yeah.
The greatest president for the African American community, yeah. Black community, yeah. Brown, absolutely. Mocha.
You truly are the best president since Abraham Lincoln.
Thank you. Yes.
Man, you the first Black president.
You can't do nothing but laugh at the fuck shit of it all. Big sigh. I bet they had watermelon and chicken casserole to top off the event. In other political news, several Democratic contenders dropped out of the race this week. Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Mayor Bloomberg, after spending half a billion only to win American Samoa, and sadly, Elizabeth Warren, who, in my opinion, was the most qualified contender remaining in the race. Now we're down to three septuagenarian white men, none of whom have a Black agenda and have records of giving marginal fucks about Black people. I'm over Bernie and frankly would like him to just go away. No damn near 80-year-old white man is leading a revolution ever. A John Brown, he is not. His ideas are just purely theoretical. He's never implemented any of his socialist, harebrained ideas in his home state of Vermont. Not to mention, you can't ever get him to discuss Black shit. Whenever he is asked about reparations, he always reverts back to semantics.
Well, it depends on how you define reparations.
Fuck out of here. Suddenly you've forgotten your command of the English language? Reparations, as in compensation and money payable by the United States for damages sustained by 12 and a half million sub-Saharan enslaved Africans and their progeny? To be clear, go away, Bernie. And obviously, it's never Trump, so by default, go Biden. Did y'all hear about Tavis Smiley? So a jury on Wednesday found that the former PBS host violated the morals clause of his contract by having affairs with multiple subordinates. Like, I've heard some tea about Tavis Smiley for years, but anyway, Smiley sued PBS in February of 2018 and alleged that the broadcaster had used a sham investigation as pretext to cancel his show. PBS, in turn, countersued, claiming that Smiley's sexual conduct constituted a breach of their contract. The jury deliberated on Monday, and they issued the final verdict in favor of PBS. And now, Tavis is ordered to pay $1.5 million to the network. Y'all stop violating the G code in the workplace. Like, you never heard of the concept, don't shit where you eat? He's half a century years old behaving in this manner. I swear to you, man be acting so stupid sometimes. And the latest coronavirus updates, California Governor Gavin Newsom, that's an old sexy white man. I totally would break my WASP restriction to be with that man. But anyway, the governor declared a state of emergency in the state of California as the state saw its first coronavirus death. In a further declaration, Governor Newsom announced people who believe they may have coronavirus can get tested for the disease without any out-of-pocket expense. Which brings to mind that there have been fewer than 6,000 coronavirus tests in the United States. In a country of more than 320 million people, the numbers captured of coronavirus cases are skewed as fuck. There's no way of determining what the real numbers are if there's no robust system set up to have people tested. Even South Korea has tested 140,000 people already. The nation has strengthened their capacity to conduct as many as 10,000 tests per day and has even built drive-through testing clinics that can detect the virus in just 10 minutes or less. The U.S. needs to take a page out of the South Korea playbook, apparently. I also got news that a case has made it to South Africa. I'm not personally in panic mode, but I'm far less inclined to get on an airplane right now. And I typically live in the air for my next visa run. My passport may make it over the border, but I won't. Anyway, y'all stay safe. Protect your neck in these streets. And that's it for...
Let me tell y'all motherfuckers what happened last week.
Until next time. Bonnie Iris Manley is a leading international speaker on courage, a two-time best-selling author, attorney, entrepreneur, and a woman that is fueled with a passion of unwavering courage. Hailed as having balls and ovaries of courage from her daredevil move to Paris, where Bonnie knew no one or one word of French, but went purely on universal signs that led her to the iconic City of Lights, to starting her own business when she knew nothing about how to run a business except how to be a lawyer, to living in five countries, learning three languages, changing careers midstream, Bonnie is no stranger to taking big leaps. She empowers audiences across the globe to stop acting as life is a dress rehearsal, get out of their comfort zones, connect with their inner courage, and have the audacity to be the leading stars of their lives instead of living life of default. The founder and principal of W. Manley, a boutique corporate and securities law firm that Bonnie started in 2008 when she got laid off, Bonnie has never looked back and has been an entrepreneur ever since, serving some of the most recognizable companies in the world, including MasterCard, Visa, Office Depot, just to name a few. As a charismatic leader and speaker, Bonnie delivers customized keynotes with teams, leaders, and organizations about her unique insights on courage that have made her successful in life. Welcome, Bonnie.
Oh my God, thank you so much. What a nice welcome.
You have an impeccable bio. So I'm very excited about doing this interview with you. So a bit of background, you started in 2010 when like a major paradigm shift had occurred in your life. And you mentioned in one of your speaking engagements that you were reeling from a heartbreak of ending a relationship with your life partner. You were fired from your job, I guess, a couple of years before that, and you were not satisfied with the productivity levels from being so wrapped up in love. And you cite that the process that you went through and how you identified your beliefs and began forgiving yourself. Can you speak a bit more about that and how that mindset shift prepared you to step out of your comfort zone and move to Paris?
Sure. Literally it was New Year's Eve in 2010 and I woke up. I was living in Miami at the time in my condo and I had plans to go out and party like I always with my friends at a friend's place in Coconut Grove. And I just woke up that morning. I was like, okay, you have no business going out tonight. You need to like literally sit down, like look at your life. Cause I had a very, very tough year. My firm I was doing pretty bad in business. My heart was so broken from, you know, a breakup of a relationship from the first guy I ever fell in love with. And I was having like chest pains and, you know, just all these were just going on with me. And so I basically just kind of stayed at home and I stayed in my loft and I did this process where I analyzed my year. I first looked at all the things that I had achieved, I wrote it down. And then I looked at the things that I had failed at and was like a super, super long list. And then I went through every single one of them and took full responsibility and was asking, okay, what was really going on? At the heart of it all was like, I was in love, my heart was broken, so I really wasn't focused on business. So obviously I wasn't meeting my business goals. I then went and looked at my belief structure because I had been on a spiritual journey and I was quite aware that everything was happening in my reality was because of my creation based on my belief structure. So I began writing out all of my limiting beliefs of I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, you don't have this, you don't have that. And I got on all fours and just prayed the most reverent prayer I've ever prayed in my life. And I just asked the universe, God, great, to help me let go of those limiting beliefs. And then I went through just sort of to forgive myself for, you know, for whatever had happened, because, you know, we only have the capacity to do what we can based on our level of awareness. And then I took a sip, like I took some water and I ate a little bit. Then I took a switch to the next part of the day where I began to look at my future. I had bought a journal and it had the word imagine on it. And I literally wrote that in that journal, everything I wanted to be, do, or have, or to experience in 2011. And I always, when I speak about this, I always tell people that I believe that particular day, you always hear about think big, you know, but for me at that point, it had always been like a theoretical concept, but for some reason I was writing in that journal what I feel like Elon Musk must think like on a normal basis, because I was writing the most outrageous and out, you know, just out of like, how is it gonna happen type thing, but I really wasn't concerned about that. I began to visualize, I began to do some mantras in Sanskrit, and by midnight I was exhausted. I took a sip of champagne out of my glass and I passed out. And what had it started to happen, and I would say that nowhere on that list that I wrote down that I said I wanted to move to Paris or I wanted to move to Miami, but I really definitely was ready for a change. And what happened was that 3 days later, I began having this phenomenon in Miami where my entire space, frequency, vibration, everywhere I went, I kept getting all of these signs pointing me to Paris, 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 France, France, France. And I had zero connection to the city, to the culture. I was not the typical American that was all crazy Google out about Paris at all. And so it was just out of the abnormal. And so for an entire year, I kept getting all these signs that kept pointing me there. I actually came here in February to kind of to investigate what the signs were all about. And I was here for 4 days. I got a hotel by the Eiffel Tower because most of the signs was of the Eiffel Tower. And I was here in a meditative state, like just wanting to receive, okay, what's the message? And I got nothing. I then went to the Riviera for the very first time. And I was with a friend of mine from Denmark and his wife, they just got married from Lebanon. And they were living in the Riviera in Jean Le Pen. And so I stayed with them and I went through Aix-en-Provence. And then I just basically went through all the different cities along the Riviera except Saint-Tropez. When I was in Monaco, I had this really strange happening to me where everything looked super familiar. And I remember coming out of a cafe and I just passed this water fountain, which is the symbol of my astrological sign of Pisces, with two fishes swimming upside down. Yeah. And I finally heard, your life is in transition from a lawyer to a writer. Wow. And that was finally the message that I finally got something, right? And I was like, okay. But I was like, big deal, because I had started writing at this time. I started blogging and, you know, I was like, okay, that's it. So, all right, whatever. So I go back to Miami thinking so much for that. That would be the end of the signs. However, it actually wasn't. Literally, the signs doubled, it tripled, and literally every single day I was just bombarded with signs pointing into Paris. And when in August, I was working downtown Miami in Brickell, and I remember it was one of these days where it was such a beautiful day in Miami. You want to be in the water, like on a yacht, you know, at the beach. And I remember seeing like these like yellow butterflies, and I was like, wow, this is kind of unusual with all of these butterflies, you know, flying so high. And when I noticed the butterflies, I just heard my heart say, move. I looked at my boot and I heard, move to Paris. I thought about it for like 20 seconds maximum. I just said yes. And at the time I had my condo in the market. It was the housing crisis. Found a buyer, sold the car. I sold my Porsche. I sold the loft that I had. I gave all of my things to different charities. I reduced an entire one bedroom loft apartment to three suitcases. I only kept my files that I had to keep legally from my law firm at a friend's garage in Miami. And I moved to Paris. I didn't know one single person here. I didn't know one word of the language. I didn't have a plan A, a plan B, a plan C. I just had zero clue as to what the hell I was getting myself into. But as I always tell people, that I didn't come to Paris, Paris called me to it. And I just was able to follow the calling that the universe placed on my life.
Wow. It actually reminds you, you had to be in tune already to even be receiving these spiritual messages. So, I mean, you seem like maybe you had hit a rock bottom around 2010, but there was something in your spirit that was still connected to the divine. So that's wonderful that you adhere to the signs. But it reminds me in 2011, when I moved to Brazil, it was the same thing. I just bought a ticket to go on a solo vacation initially. And like maybe about 4 weeks before my departure date, I was like, fuck this, I'm moving there. I didn't know the language. I didn't know anyone on the continent. So kudos to you for taking the leap. it's kind of leads me to the next question, because you mentioned that, you know, you sold your loft in Miami, you sold your car, and you downsized. You didn't have a plan. You didn't know the language. But in order to let go, or in order to will abundance in your life, sometimes you have to let go. Can you speak more about the ripple effects of leveling up and what you have to prepare to release in order to do that?
Well, I will share with you, at that time in my life, it wasn't quite rock bottom, but it was just like, I'm just over Miami. I'm over, I'm ready. It was more of a ready for a change more than anything. And so me letting go of the physical things was quite easy, because I'm a type of person, I don't keep a lot of clutter anyway. Mm-hmm. But the real letting go for me was actually when I arrived here and I realized that I was being called to a different version of myself. In fact, when I left Miami, my spiritual teacher told me that I was coming here on a karmic cleansing mission to let go of my karma. Mm. My hopeless romantic girlfriend said that I was coming to meet the love of my life.
Oh, you're a Pisces too.
Huh?
You're a Pisces. You guys love love.
Exactly. You know, we like the adventure and spontaneity too. So one of my girlfriends began planning my wedding, right? But I'll tell you what, it was my hairdresser in Houston that said this to me, like I saw the day before I left, and she said to me, Wanda, you know what? You're not going to Paris to meet the one that your friends are thinking about. You're going to Paris to meet the one that you've always wanted to meet, and that is yourself, your real self. And when she said that to me, it just literally, like, it just stuck with me, you know? And so I realized when I, by the way, all those things were actually true. All those things came true for me. But I realized more so than anything was that in order for me to become the greatest version of myself, to step into my destiny, because I realized that Paris was bringing me towards what I was meant to be doing for the rest of my life, was I had to let go of who I thought I was, the lawyer version of me, or who I thought my life was actually going to be like. I had to let go of my foundation. I had to let go of what I thought my life was going to be like, and to embrace a different version of my, like a speaker. I never saw myself as a speaker. I never saw myself as a writer. My entire life, I thought I was going to be practicing law. I grew up in a diplomat. My father was a public figure. I grew up around dignitaries all the time, and, you know, in Africa. So it was just like, what do you mean I'm not going to be a lawyer anymore? So I had to let go of this part of me. I had to let go of the self-imposed limitations of like what I think I could make or what I think I could do, and become a person who can speak French and who does this and who does that, you know? So that was the most difficult part.
Yeah, I've had to, you've also lived on five different countries, and like, this is my fourth continent as an expat. And I left from Qatar and came to Johannesburg, and it's a much, much different life. And, you know, I sold my luxury car. I gave up my flat on the, you know, overlooking the Gulf, and I came to Johannesburg. And then, like, in comparison, it's like, it's not a bad lifestyle, but it's roughing it, but it's the same thing. Like, I've had to redefine who I am. Like, who is Felina without six figures and, you know, all the she foo-foo trimmings, you know? So I completely get it. So you mentioned that you are an American born to Liberian parents, and as good African children do, you chose a very safe career as an attorney. So when you made your career pivot into entrepreneurship and as a motivational speaker and an author, did you get any pushback from your parents?
Oh my God. I still do.
Still? Are you serious? Oh my goodness.
I am. You know, and I would share with you that that's been part of the most difficult things that I had to deal with in Paris was not, or feeling my family withdraw from me. My parents just asked me, get a job. How's the job hunt going, right? They're also African people, and they're all about safety, right? So they don't really quite understand or, you know, can see. And I know they're coming from a place of love, but I have never had the support. I do now of my mother. My father is still not quite around, you know, and it's been a very difficult part of my journey, but I've had to come to a conclusion that it's my life to live. And I'm here to make me happy, not to make anybody else is happy. And I'm living my dharma, I'm living my path. And yeah, it's been difficult. It's been fun, but it's also been very, very extremely hard. And, you know, and I'm not where I used to be. When they saw me in Miami, I was like working this like bling bling marble building. I was driving a Porsche. I was like in this like high rise, beautiful loft. And it's like in Paris, I'm like living like 17 different apartments. Like, what's going on? Like, it's like I've been so unstable, you know? And so they just sort of approve of it. But I think they realize that they can't change my mind. And I, for me, we're no longer fighting. It's not a contentious issue, because I realize that they're coming from a place of love within their hearts, and they're a different generation.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, they just want to make sure I'm okay. That's all they. And for them, being okay means working for a corporation or the government and having a steady paycheck and health insurance and benefits.
Yeah, I think, you know, initially when I started my expat journey like 10 years ago, I was in the throes of applying to PhD programs, and, you know, that was going to be my trajectory, like being a tenured professor. And when I told my dad I was moving, he cut a check for the first leg of my journey without asking. But he definitely was not with the program initially. Like, not at all. But I mean, I have his full support now. So you mentioned that you've lived in 5 countries, the US, Liberia, Spain, Italy, and now France. How has France, I should say, having immersive experiences and being an expat informed the way that you've been able to engage with global audiences as a speaker and author?
My God, it's so enriching. You know, my soul is truly, truly universal, and I feel very, very special. And I just, for me, it's allowed me to be able to adapt. You know, by me having these colorful experiences from a very young age, as since 1 year old, it just means I don't quite have the baggage of, you know, okay, I'm an American and this is how I do it. Because I'm used to being in other people's culture and being in other people's, you know, fundamental diaphragm. So for me, it's allowed me to connect with different types of people and make me relatable in the sense of where I'm not this like so cemented into who I am, or in terms of this is my belief structure, you know? And it's just because at the end of the day, all of these labels we put on ourselves, like I'm French or I'm this, is completely bull, because we're all human beings. In fact, we're actually spiritual beings having a human experience, and everything is energy, and we connect at the heart level. And so I just bypass all of that. But, you know, it just, you know, for me, I have a very worldly view of everything. And so for me, it really helps me to connect and speak with people that in a way that I think, like, people who don't have that experience, I think you probably agree too, it's just as difficult for them.
Yeah. I feel foreign in, I feel foreign everywhere, but I feel most foreign in the United States. And that's
the country of my birth.
Yeah. I mean, except in, like, I'm from LA, so like, except like when I'm home, but like just generally speaking, yeah, that reverse culture shock returning is a real thing.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say that, you know, I was actually in the U.S. for 2 years. I returned back to France in, like, last year in May. And I was in Miami for 2 years in Houston. And I just felt like I was in a twilight zone. And I was like, what is this? So I know what you mean. It's like, I do feel like a foreigner. I felt so French when I went, or Parisian, when I went back to Miami. I was very surprised by, actually.
How long did it take you to, like, become fully immersed and learn the language and the lay of the land?
Well, you know, I'm going to say I'm actually still learning it. So part of my experience here was that I was actually, the first couple of years, I was splitting my time between Miami and Paris. Like, I would spend the winters in Miami because I don't do winters, you know, and
tell me about it.
And I was just also, you know, because I came here, I didn't know how to say one word in French, you know, and so by the time, and it was just so far out of my comfort zone. I mean, like, the first time I ever, like, washed my clothes, I cried. I mean, I didn't know how to read the
laundry machine. I've had that experience. several different places. Breakdown over that kind of shit.
Exactly. I was just so distraught. I was like, you're a freaking lawyer and you can't even read to put, you know, the soap in the right dispenser. I was so tearful, you know, and I was just like, this is cannot be my life type thing, right? So for me, by the end of like, you know, by November, December, my inner child would be like, get me the hell out of this place. I need to get back to my comfort zone, to my world, to where I can understand the Spanish and English and be around relaxed people. So for me, that I just kept going back and forth. But I now, looking back on my journey, realized that that was actually hurting me. Because each time I would come back to Paris, I would be starting completely over again. It would be like, it would just be so brand new to me because there was never this continuity as there is now for me. So,
and you know, that's one thing about France is that, you know, they know full well they speak English, but I kind of appreciate that, like, they force you to learn their culture and adapt to their customs and their language, because yeah, everybody outside of the United States is at least knows one other language.
Yeah.
I like, you know, one of the things I really enjoy about Paris is the bread shops. And, like, the names are so sexy. A boulangerie, like, ooh, I'm going to, it just sounds so sexy. So you've also lived in Spain and Italy. What were your experiences like in other European countries?
I hated Spain. Spain was my second after Liberia, and I was there for study abroad. You know, that was actually the first time I realized I was Black. It was my first time ever.
Wait, stop, stop. Record scratch. Wait. Come again.
It was the first time let me just back up. So my experience in living in the United States, I've never experienced racism from white people.
Really?
I've always experienced, and this is typical, this for many African people, at least my generation, we'll all tell you the same thing. I've always experienced racism from Black American people. Wow. I was always teased about being African, my features. I remember when I came from Africa and I was in school, like the way I would speak and I would get laughed at, I would be called African booty scratcher.
Oh my gosh.
There would be so many times I would go to a Black beauty salon and they would have no idea that I was actually African, and they would say the things about those African people. So it was just like that. So my torment from discrimination was always a gift from.
Okay, let me say this. I'm going to apologize because this is obviously well before I've become evolved and a world traveler. But I remember being like, you know, a kid, like in like six and 7 years old, and calling African students like, that's so mean. It speaks to the propaganda that, and here I am living in Africa now, and I wouldn't want to be any other place, right? Place I'd rather be on earth right now. So actually that's like, yeah, I'm sorry that you had that experience from us. I apologize on behalf of my people.
Well, I appreciate that, because I can tell you that all of my generation and even my younger siblings, they all go through that. They're not, I mean, the racism that we experience comes from that, from Black American people. So I really, really appreciate that, because you're probably actually the first person that ever said that to me. So really, really take that into heart. So that was my experience with racism. When I got to Spain, I was in Madrid, and this is right, it was in 2000, right before the Euro, and this was before Spain had any laws of immigration on the books. And at the time I had no hair, I looked like a Moroccan. And I'm telling you, everywhere I went, I was denied access. This is like, I was living like Jim Crow, like they describe in the 50s and 60s Americans, but I was living it in Spain. I would go to restaurants, they would tell me they were closed. Sometimes I was, this is, by the way, I should mention, this was only in Madrid. When I went outside of Madrid, I had no issues. I would shake people's hands in Madrid and they would wipe their hands on front, like on their things, you know? And yeah, I would be denied, you know, service at restaurants. I was constantly harassed by the police. I always had to show my papers, my school papers as to why I was there, my passport. I was constantly in the American at the embassy complaining about harassment. It was awful. To this day, I have zero love for Spain, except for Ibiza, which I absolutely love. But it was a very tormented experience for me of just being there and not, you know, and just.
How old were you? You said you were on a study abroad, so you were in college.
This is like my second year of law school.
Okay.
Yeah, this is my second year of law school. Oh. I went to Spain. So I don't know how old I was. I'm 44 now. But and so that it was just very traumatic for me, you know. And I remember I found refuge in this like Cuban restaurant, the center of, you know, oh. I was living in the very center of Spain. And I remember when the school, because I went early, I actually was supposed to be there a lot later than what I was supposed to be. But at the time I was dating, you know, I had a boyfriend who was on the track of the Olympic team, and he was there training earlier, so I went to meet up with him. And I remember when the school started, the professor said to me that, you know, it's not because of your color. I go, yes, it is. He goes, yeah, you're right. But he did tell me that at the time there was a huge influx of Africans that were coming through Morocco over to Spain. And Spain had zero immigration laws on the books. The Africans were not really, you know, connecting with their custom. Like, for example, they would never take a siesta. They were always working. And then also, too, he said to me that the area I was living, which is Puerto del Sol, was where a lot of, like, the drug trades by Moroccans were. They were all selling weed. He's like, they think you're probably a mule, like, passing drugs around, or because of how you look. And I was like, ah, okay, you know. So, yeah, when I left Spain, I was just like, if I never come back here, I'm okay.
Wow. Yeah, I had a really, like, racist, fucked up experience in Spain as well. Gosh, I don't know how long ago. It's probably been like 12 years ago. But I was there with one of my homegirls, the Vietnamese chick, and her son. We were there with her son. She's from France. And we did like a road trip. And we were mistaken for prostitutes like at every turn. I'm like, yo, we are with her whole child right now. Like, surely you don't think that we are out here turning tricks with children. Like, it was horrible. I didn't have that experience in Madrid, but I wasn't, I probably wasn't there long enough to have a negative experience. So you
what
were
year was that? I'm curious, what year was that for you?
Goodness, let me think. I was going through a divorce at that time, and I went on a, when was that? I think it was like 2009.
Okay.
2009. Yeah. 2009. Yeah, it was. It sucked. So I can tell you about Spain. What about Italy?
Yeah, Spain from us 2000. Italy was a completely different experience. I mean, in Italy, I am a saint. I always say to people, I think in a past life, I must have been like a Spanish like murderer because I said, and then I also must have been like an Italian saint because it doesn't explain the two different treatments. When I'm in Italy, it's like I'm a queen, like I am here in France, but it's just like, Italy is just, it's to me, it's the country of love. And it's just such a beautiful, it's just, I actually love that country. And it's just a completely different experience. So much love from strangers, just the outpouring of love every single day. And just, it's an exceptional culture.
Yeah, I agree with you about, you know, the best courtship that I ever received from a man was from an Italian guy. It was just, oh my gosh. I mean, I wish I had the presence of mind then to like be more amenable to being with a white man.
Let me tell you, I completely agree. My favorite type of men to date are Italian men. Most of my relationships have been with Italian men. And I tell you what, they definitely know about courts. They know how to treat women. They know it.
It's on another level. It's on
completely.
I mean, look, this man, just a little girl chit chat. This man, like, he learned me I met him like the day after Valentine's Day. I met him on Valentine's Day coming out of a liquor store. And we both didn't have Valentine's, and so we exchanged numbers. And he like learned me for like a week, and he had a restaurant and he was a chef. And he held his restaurant open like after hours, and he curated a playlist for me. He made my favorite food. I mean, it was amazing. Like, this what you do on a first date? Okay. I'm all the way with it, but I wasn't with it. I was too young. I was too young to appreciate that.
I love Italian men. In fact, I have a nickname for them. I call them gems. Gems. J, like pronounced like a gem, but it's pronounced G-I-M. Gorgeous Italian men are my men of choice. I just, those men are just, I love them.
I can't, you know, I just can't do WASP. I'm not into WASP, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, because I'm like, you know, I might fuck around and have a transatlantic flashback and it just would not be good. I just don't think it would work. Anyway, so you've also lived in Liberia. You mentioned that your dad was minister there. So what was your experience like living in Liberia?
So yeah, my father's he's a former minister of finance, and he's a huge public figure. So I was in Liberia from right around one year old until almost age nine. And I was in between that time, my mom was in the U.S. going to nursing school. And so in the summertime, I would travel to the U.S. and be with her and spend time with her. So for me, what I remember at that time was like, that was when my dad was at his prime. He was minister of finance. So I was always at the executive mansion, which is equivalent to the White House.
Was that when Charles Taylor was?
This was the administration my father was working for was Samuel Doe, and that's the administration that Charles Taylor took over during like the coup. And so my recollection of being in Liberia was just like, I mean, it was beautiful. You know, I was always around with my father, and this is probably where this whole thing about becoming a lawyer, you know, came out, because my father was like, he took me everywhere with him to the executive mansion. I was always meeting heads of state, ambassadors, you know, so that was like the world that I was living in. And business people, like at the time when I was in Liberia, there was all of our commerces were, there was a lot of Lebanese people, a lot of Lebanese men, I should say, that were actually there, and also Australian men. So they were like in the lumber industry. So, you know, as my father being minister of finances, so there was always with business people. So for me, I got early on the mindset of business and dignitaries and, you know, ambassadorship and like that track. And so for me, it was just kind of like, I saw my path being kind of shaped, and I don't know where I got this from, but when I was 6 years old, I said that I wanted to live between the United States and Europe, which I'm doing now, and I've always wanted to have three homes. But I can say that that experience really with my father really, I think, shaped the first trajectory of my life. So I wanted to be like, you know, my ideal career, I wanted to be Madeleine Albright. I wanted to be Secretary of State, or, you know, work for the UN, be an ambassador. So, and I know it all came from that, from what my father was actually doing. So that was my recollection of it.
Liberia has such a special significance to the United States and African Americans because you probably know more about the specific dates than I do, but there was a time when land was appointed to some of the freed enslaved blacks to go and move to Liberia. When I first got out of college, actually, I worked for a Liberian organization in Philadelphia. Shout out to African Cultural Alliance of North America. That's excellent. So, you're also an author, among many other things. So, in your latest book, Get Out of Survival Mode and Live the Life You Really Want, you reveal 108 of the most self-defeating habits, beliefs, and attitudes that keep people in a struggle. Can you share some insights to someone in the Black Broads Abroad audience who is perhaps in a rut and trying to figure their shit out, whether it's leaving their job, their man, their grown-ass kids, and escaping to a new place? Like, what advice would you give on where to start to make an actionable plan?
The first thing I would say is to tune into your heart and to tune into your desires and to say, okay, what do I really, really want? And I would say that when you go on that query, you will probably hear crickets. And it's because we're not used to giving ourselves what we want. And I was also says, especially Black women, because we're so, women in general are meant to be nurturers, right? And we've always, we're groomed to be, you know, taking care of other people. I think for Black women specifically, we have to be always strong all the time, right? And like, because it's just certain dynamics. And so I would say tune into your heart. And I'll say that because the reason why you have a desire, it's because it's meant to manifest. It's not just there for the hell of it, right? And so the way to get your life back into order is to tune into your heart's desire and to begin to listen for that guidance and to follow it. It will not just come to you like the entire plan, but what you will be getting will be like little nudges or things that makes you feel curious to actually follow that. And you have to just like to put one step in front of the other and just follow it. I would say that it's not all going to be aligned for you. For example, you know, I didn't wait for the stars to align to have a certain amount of money in my bank account to move to Paris. In fact, my second time coming to Paris, I came with like less than $500.
What?
Yes. That's a story in itself.
That's a whole other book, honey. Oh my God.
But I know. And so, yeah, I mean, I can get into it if you would like me to, but to just to make sure.
I would love for you to elaborate about that.
So my move to Paris. What's that?
It speaks a lot to stepping out on faith.
For sure. So my move to Paris came in multiple moves, right? The first time I came, I actually came with money. I came with about $5,000. And I had a recounter student because I had my law firm. I was only here for 2 months the first time I came back because at the time I did have a few cases, and I had to go back to Miami to hear those cases in court and also to for certain events that I never missed March in Miami. Then the second time I came back was in the summer, was 3 months after that. And I came, like I literally had like $460 on me, right? But I had accounts receivables of clients that were, you know, were paying me. These were like my bread and butter clients, right? So I was confident that I would be okay. But it was so funny because when I left I flew out of Houston. I remember like telling my mom how much money I had. My mom almost fainted, right? And so when I came, let me tell you, right? And when I first came, I had met some people. So I had like some things in place of where to stay. Mid-flight, when I landed in Paris, I learned that my 3-week accommodations was now a 24-hour accommodation. And I was like, holy crap, what am I going to do? So anyway, I reached out to someone I had met. And she's like, you can come stay on my couch, no problem. And so I at least had a place to stay at that point. But that particular summer, I literally had to receive like this rude awakening and leaning into the universe for abundance. That particular summer, none of my clients paid me.
What?
And I'm telling you, none of my clients paid me. These were like my bread and butter clients I had been surviving off of for years. One client in particular, these were all actually public traded companies. I was doing securities work for them. They would like literally, this one particular client would put money in my bank account or instruct the CFO to actually do it. And then he would send an email saying, hey, Juan, I need a legal opinion on blah, 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 blah. I've actually told John to put, you know, $5,000 in your bank account. And I would look there, would be there. All of that was gone.
Wow.
And I had to literally lean on faith. That summer, I think I was in 7 or 8 different apartments. And I was in such fear. And I had to face my worst fear of being unstable, of being homeless, of not having money, of how am I going to eat. And I had to face, there was just a couple of times I was just like, this is freaking crazy. But let me tell you what happened, though. Actually, when I landed, 4 days later, I had this out-of-body experience where my first book got downloaded to me, and I wrote that book in 30 days. Hmm. And so I was told
Wait. Are you saying that you had an out-of-body experience writing your book, or that you had a vision about writing your book?
This is what happened. 4 days after I arrived here, I was freaking out, right? Because I had all these things in place. I didn't know yet that at that point it wasn't, you know, I was okay in terms of money wise because I didn't know that nobody was going to pay me for the rest of the summer. And, but what was jarring was not really having a secure place anymore because when I came, I had a place for 3 weeks. And I remember the fourth day I was here, I went to go see this spiritual leader named Jeff Foster from England speak about the path of acceptance. And I remember just being so annoyed when he was speaking. And I left the talk and I came back home to the apartment where I was staying at. And I just had this like agitation feeling within me. I was like watching different things and listening to different spiritual things. And I was just so annoyed and I just stopped it. And I started doing some chanting and I was saying, okay, relax, Wani, you're okay. You're not the mind, you're not the body, you're not the bank account, everything is okay. And I kept repeating these things. And I had an experience where I just had this recognition that all of life was a stage that I was at. We were all actors and actresses, which is the truth. And it's just like, I was really acting this out. And I began to feel the presence of angels around me. And I was like, okay, you guys brought me here. What am I supposed to do? Where am I going to live? How am I going to make any money? Am I supposed to actually be living here? I just like left my entire life in Miami. And I heard, you are here to write books and make speeches. Here's the first book you're going to write. It's about the spiritual journey. And it was downloaded to me that weekend. I remember being downloaded the table of contents. And for that entire summer, Felena, I was vomiting that book. I mean, I was going to restaurants where I was writing on napkins. Wow. I was just pouring through me like a tsunami. And I wrote that book in 30 days.
Wow.
And I spent 2 years actually editing it. And then, in fact, that's a book that I'm going to publish right now. But the book you're talking about, that was my second book that I published first. And so, yeah, Paris for me was a way to bring the writer out of me, the speaker out of me. And I learned so many lessons about trusting, about faith, of taking a big leap with your life, of trusting God, the universe, and knowing that when you're following the path that has been laid before you, no matter how risky it looks, no matter how illogical it may seem, that you're always okay. You're always taken care of and everything is gonna be provided for you. I would tell you, there would be people I would meet. I remember meeting this one girl from Morocco who I met her like once at a cafe. The second time I was talking to her, she's like, you know what? She goes, I'm going to Morocco with my brothers for my brother's graduation. My apartment's available for 2 weeks. Something in my spirit is telling me to offer you my apartment. I don't know where you're living, but something is just telling me to offer you my apartment. I smoke. I hope you don't mind. I know you look very healthy. You know, I was experiencing a lot of those synchronicities and a lot of those gifts from the universe because of the way I was engaging life, because of the way that I was opening up to this universal force that's actually guiding our lives. And I tell people, when you really open up to it, your life becomes magical. So talking to that person who's struggling right now, who wants to leave their job, leave their marriage, or they know they're looking for a change, I'm going to tell you right now, you know what your heart is nudging you to do. You're just afraid to actually do it because you don't quite have it all figured out, or it seems illogical, it doesn't make any sense, or you don't have the money or the whatever. I'm saying do it anyway. When you take bold steps with your life, the universe steps in and it steps in to help you big time. Everything that I'm living is because I got on that airplane with less than 500 bucks and I'm not even knowing I was not going to get paid for 3 months.
Wow.
And let me tell you, at the end of that 3 months, I had to go back to the United States and I literally at the very end got rewarded with three full paid trips, two back-to-back trips to Italy.
Wow.
And then when I got to Miami, I went on a full paid trip to Bahamas.
Wow.
Crazy style. I mean, it's so illogical. And I always tell people what I teach is that, listen, have a belief system that defies logic. Because when you do, you step into the magicalness of the universe. It's a whole different world.
Yeah, it definitely is. Like, you know, I came to South Africa actually kicking and screaming. I bought property here a few years ago. And I mean, it was basically like a rental property while I was living in Qatar. And I came here kicking and screaming, you know, like I left a really bad relationship that turned into being an abusive one. And it was crazy. Like my six-figure job was gone, you know, my luxury cars were gone. I was almost essentially homeless in the United States. I had to flee a bad situation and I had to come back here. And like, you know, I wasn't getting those big checks I used to get in Qatar anymore, honey. I came here with a few thousand dollars, and God has provided so many provisions from just being obedient and coming. So that's beautiful. Your story is beautiful. What's the biggest lesson that you have learned to date about stepping outside of your comfort zone?
Oh my God. You know, as uncomfortable as it is, that is where everything you desire is. Everything. That's where everything your heart desires outside of your comfort zone. And so long as you're in your comfort zone, you're not growing and nothing is happening. That place where we're comfortable is dead.
Amen.
It's dead.
She said it's dead.
It's completely dead. I'm not saying where you don't have some type of stability in your life and you're just constantly like, you know, in stress mode. No. I'm just saying like where you know you're not growing.
Yeah. It's true. Nothing magical happens in comfort zones, like nothing at all. What new projects are you working on now? What should people look out for in 2020 from Wani?
Well, I'm about to publish my next book, which is the first book that I ever wrote, and it's called There is Spirituality and There is Truth. And it's all about what happens when you get on a spiritual journey of how your life actually transforms and the things you actually need to know about that journey that nobody tells you should actually be knowing. And more speaking engagements. And so I will be on a huge speaking circuit. I'm getting ready to go back to speak at like my middle school, my law school. I've been invited to speak in Australia. And so
Oh my gosh, that's so dope. Have you been to Australia before?
I never have, you know, but it's been on my spirit, and I want to go back. I'm going back to Bali, and I'm like, you know, God, I want to go speak in Australia. So I've had two opportunities, and the second one I'm going to take it, which I'm really looking forward to. And I'm also just looking forward to doing some philanthropy work. Right now I'm looking to connect with organizations just to give back, because I have been given so much, and it's time for me to bring my energy outward into that. And so I'm looking for to be more connected with that. Definitely more books. I'm also writing my fourth book, which is my Paris memoir, 84 Rue de Nolet, which is all about when I left Miami on that New Year's Eve, what happened to me, and telling everyone what that story has actually been about me living here, my Paris experience. So many more books after that. You know, my other book will probably be about French men and what that experience actually has been here. So many more books, many more speaking, and just really like helping people transform and inspiring people, like living my best life, you know, and helping other people do the exact same thing as well too.
Well, I'm glad you adhere to God's calling on your life, because you are definitely doing the Lord's work. Where can people keep up with your journey and follow you on social media?
Definitely my website. It's WaniManley.com, and I'm on Instagram, and it's at the lovely Wani, Twitter, the lovely Wani, but definitely Instagram and Facebook are my big hubs. You can find me there. And so Facebook is my name, and then Instagram is the lovely Wani.
Wonderful. I'll put the links in the bio. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such a great conversation. I wish it didn't have to end. And I can't wait to meet you. Like I said, maybe in South Africa, for speaking at a business group there, hopefully if that actually pans out. So I would love to meet you in person. And
love to meet you. Support. Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And your badass attitude, all your negativity, and all that other shit. Keep that shit to your fucking self. Because on this side, we're fucking positive.
Anyone else have a word from the Lord, a testimony of God's goodness?
I've got a word from the Lord on today. Thank you, brother, for that riveting reminder to fuck negativity. How is y'all's 2020 going? We've almost reached the end of the first quarter.
And in my first episode, my Sunday sermon was all about keeping them squares about your circle. How's that going for y'all? I'm still progressing full fucking steam ahead, and I'm grateful, hallelujah, for the people who have self-eliminated from my life or who I otherwise just completely cut off. My cutoff game is strong as fuck. Such as the instance I mentioned at the top of the show, with a friend revealing her true colors in a paltry attempt at a read. Sometimes people will project their insecurities onto you, and that is human nature, but don't fall for the okey-doke. Addition by subtraction is a real fucking thing. It's sad when you have a so-called friend that are low-key in competition with you, and like, why for? When a win for me is a win for you because I'm loyal to the soil. But you don't have but one time to show your hand with me. And to be fair, maybe being dismissive is something I need to work on, because there is a fine line in receiving truth and being introspective and a motherfucker coming for you out of a place of being unhappy with their own mediocre conditions. Discern the difference. I don't even deal with my own mama because of her bullshit and negativity. So it's absolutely no sweat off my back to not fuck with a friend acting like a foe. Okay? Toodaloo, girl. No squares in the circle is a forever vibe. Have you evaluated the players on your team? Who's in your circle really championing your cause? Pay attention to who claps for you and who caps for you. And on that note, have a blessed week ahead. Shout out to our Patreon members. Thank you so much for your support. If you too are interested in supporting the Black Broads Abroad movement, keep up with us on social media, and that's at Black Broads Abroad, BlackBroadsAbroad, and that's on IG and Facebook. And if you're interested in supporting on Patreon, visit www.patreon.com/BlackBroadsAbroad.